So, in 2024, Donald Trump won the state of Tennessee by a staggering 30 points.
Yeah, 30 points is just, it's massive.
It really is. And if you look purely at the electoral math, that state is politically locked, unbreakable.
Right. The conventional wisdom says you just cannot run a competitive statewide race as a Democrat there.
Exactly. But what happens when a challenger raises this functional statewide army and just decides to try and break that math anyway?
Well, you end up with one of the most fascinating laboratories for political strategy in the country. I mean, you get a race that forces us to ask whether local, everyday issues can actually, pierce through the armor of nationalized partisan loyalty.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Today is Monday, August 24, 2026, and we are unpacking a massive, highly detailed, and strictly neutral research report jointly published by the American newspaper and the Tennessee Times.
Yeah, it's a great report.
We are looking squarely at the newly set general election matchup for the 2026 Tennessee governor's race.
Specifically, we're looking at the Democratic nominee, Jerry Green, taking on the Republican incumbent, Marsha Blackburn.
Right. And the mission for our deep dive today, for everyone listening, is to really get past the talking points. We are going to unpack the cold, hard electoral arithmetic, the massive financial disparities, and the completely opposing platform strategies.
Because we want to see exactly what it takes to run a competitive race in a state that so heavily favors one party.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with who is actually on the ticket.
So the challenger is Jerry Green, and she's running under a very specific, deliberate brand. She calls it One Tough Mother.
I love that branding. It's very catchy.
It is. She was raised in Memphis, holds a law degree from Georgetown, and she's built her career entirely in the public sector.
Right.
She served as the Shelby County Chief Public Defender and also sat on the Memphis City Council.
So her resume is intensely local, like it's municipal.
Yeah.
You hear public defender and city council, and that immediately signals to you someone who deals with, potholes,
Sure.
local budgets, county courthouses.
Yeah, very boots on the ground.
But then you look at the other side of the ballot, and the incumbent, Marsha Blackburn, she operates on a completely different stratum. I mean, she is a certified political heavyweight.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking 16 years in the U.S. House of Representatives and 2 full terms in the U.S. Senate.
Right. And her campaign isn't really emphasizing state governance at all, is it?
Not really, no. She is running aggressively on Donald Trump's America First agenda.
It is just the ultimate contrast in political scale. But to truly understand how this race is going to unfold over the next few months, you cannot just look at their resumes.
No, you have to look at the financial asymmetry because honestly, it dictates the physics of the entire campaign.
Right, so let's lay out those numbers because they are, well, they're jarring.
They really are.
Looking at the latest pre-primary filing data from the report, Jerry Green has raised roughly $698,000. And she is sitting on about $118,000 in cash on hand. Now, put that next to Blackburn's war chest. Marsh Blackburn has raised $10.77 million, with $2.69 million in cash just sitting in the bank ready to be deployed.
And we really have to clarify here for you listening that those millions only represent her official direct campaign account.
Right. The report notes that Blackburn also has an estimated $12 million in backing from aligned outside political action committees, or PACs, that was just stockpiled during the primary cycle.
Yeah, and just for context, these PACs are basically independent money machines. They can carpet bomb the state's television screens and digital platforms with ads, and the campaign doesn't have to spend a dime of its own money.
It's insane. It's like racing a bicycle against a freight train. And in this case, the freight train also brought a second $12 million freight train as backup, just to make sure you never even get on the tracks.
That's a great way to put it. And that resource gap dictates every single strategic decision. I mean, Green just cannot afford to blanket the state with television commercials.
Right, so what does she do?
She has to rely on earned media, which means getting news stations to cover her events for free, along with endless travel and grassroots mobilization.
Wow, Blackburn.
Blackburn, meanwhile, has the financial capacity to saturate every single media market in Tennessee from day one, basically drowning out any counternarrative.
Wow. But a $12 million war chest is just potential energy. To see if it actually intimidated anyone, we have to look at how voters behaved when the polls actually opened.
Yeah, let's look at the August 6th primary returns.
Because despite the financial disparity, Green absolutely dominated her side of the ticket. She took 69% of the Democratic vote, which translates to roughly 244,000 votes.
Right.
She didn't just win her home base in Memphis either. She won majorities in Nashville, Knoxville, Chattanooga, and even affluent suburban counties.
Which is huge. It proves that Green has built a very real, functional, statewide organization. Mm. She achieved intra-party dominance, basically clearing the field with a massive mandate from the Democratic base.
But then I look at the Republican primary returns, and I have a serious question about the conventional wisdom here.
Okay.
Blackburn won her primary, yes, but she only secured 43.6% of the vote, which is about 311,000 votes. Her two conservative challengers, Rose and Fritz, combined for 56.4% of the vote.
Right, a majority voted against her.
Exactly. If over half of the Republican primary voters just walked into a booth and actively voted against the sitting incumbent in her own primary, isn't that a glaring, fatal vulnerability? Doesn't the math say she's in serious trouble?
What's fascinating here is how often political observers conflate primary rebellion with general election defection.
Okay, explain that.
It is a massive trap to look at those frustrated Republican voters and assume they were going to cross the aisle in November.
Because they're just protesting.
Exactly. Most of those voters were casting protest votes because they felt Blackburn wasn't conservative enough, or they just wanted a fresh face.
Yep.
But because of negative partisanship, which is the phenomenon where voters are driven more by their dislike of the opposing party than love for their own, those voters will almost certainly come home to Blackburn when the alternative is a Democrat.
Ah, so the frustration doesn't actually translate into a willingness to flip their political identity.
Precisely. Furthermore, you really have to look at the sheer scale of the total electorate. Yes, Blackburn only got 43.6% of her primary, but the Republican primary had roughly 714,000 total voters turn out.
And the Democrats.
The Democratic primary, only 353,000.
Wow. So even a fractured, divided Republican primary generated double the foot traffic of a unified Democratic primary.
Yeah. And that leads us to the geographic dilemma that fundamentally defines Jerry Green's campaign. Her political identity is deeply rooted in Memphis, which is Shelby County.
Which is Tennessee's largest Democratic stronghold.
Right.
So from a purely mechanical standpoint, she needs a massive turnout in Memphis to have any shot at the statewide math, right? So those ties are incredibly valuable.
They're valuable for turnout, yes, but highly vulnerable as a messaging target.
How so?
To win statewide in Tennessee, a Democrat cannot just rely on urban centers. They have to make massive gains in the suburbs and rural areas of Middle and East Tennessee.
Right.
And the Blackburn campaign is already utilizing Memphis not just as a city, but as a partisan symbol. They're using Green's local ties to attach her to nationalized Republican narratives about, you know, urban crime rates and progressive city governance.
Oh, trying to scare those suburban voters in other parts of the state.
Exactly.
It's a geographic tug of war.
Yeah.
And that tension between local realities and national narratives is exactly what dictates the completely opposing policy platforms these two campaigns are bringing to you, the voter.
Absolutely.
Now, before we break down these platforms, it's really important to note for you listening,
mm-hmm.
our goal here isn't to weigh in on who has the right answers or, you know, endorse any ideology.
Right. We are strictly looking at the strategic playbooks these campaigns have built to try and capture the electorate.
No.
Impartially reporting the facts.
Exactly. So let's look at Jerry Green's strategy. Her platform is laser focused on what strategists call kitchen table economics.
Yes.
She's actively avoiding abstract cultural debates.
Yes.
And leaning heavily into the tangible costs of running a household. She wants to repeal the state grocery tax, expand Medicaid, aggressively fund rural hospitals to keep them from closing, oppose school vouchers to protect public school funding, and tackle child care wait lists.
It is incredibly physical. You know, you can feel a grocery tax every time you check out at the supermarket.
Yeah.
You feel a rural hospital closing when you have to drive an extra 40 minutes for an emergency room. But the report points out that she isn't just running on economics.
That's right.
She has taken official positions on repealing the state's near total abortion ban, legalizing medical and recreational marijuana, and this is a big one, issuing a day one order to end state and local law enforcement cooperation with ICE.
And that last point is critical. ICE is the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Promising to end local cooperation with federal immigration authorities might energize a progressive base, sure, but in a deeply conservative state, it provides Republicans with a highly potent, easily digestible attack ad.
It really does. It allows Blackburn to just pivot away from the grocery tax and make the race entirely about the southern border.
Which aligns perfectly with Marsha Blackburn's platform. Because while Green is keeping the lens focused tightly on state-level issues, Blackburn is looking almost exclusively at national policies.
Yeah, her platform prioritizes mass deportations, protecting Second Amendment gun rights, opposing abortion, fighting what she terms woke curriculum in local schools, and pushing for universal school vouchers.
It's a textbook strategy for an incumbent in a safe state, right? Just nationalize the race.
Exactly.
Looking at these two approaches, the analogy that jumps out to me is that it feels like Jerry Green is essentially running for city manager of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. You know, she wants to talk about your grocery bill, your local hospital, the budget for your kids' public school. Meanwhile, Marsha Blackburn is running for president of Tennessee. She wants to talk about international borders, national culture wars, constitutional rights.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the campaign that successfully dictates the overarching theme of this election is the campaign that wins.
Okay, break that down.
Well, if Green can make this a referendum purely on local affordability and whether you have access to a doctor, she has a mechanism to persuade conservative voters to cross party lines.
Right.
But if Blackburn successfully makes the election a referendum on national partisan identity, Trump's agenda, and immigration, then her structural advantage in a red state is simply overwhelming.
It's game over.
Yeah.
But let's assume Green's messaging actually cuts through. Let's imagine she forces the conversation onto local affordability and rural hospitals. Huh? What does the electoral arithmetic actually require to win in a state that is structurally engineered against her?
To understand just how steep this mountain is, the report points us to something called the Bridson benchmark.
Phil Bridson.
Yeah.
We're talking about the 2018 U.S. Senate race.
Right.
He was a moderate Democrat, but more importantly, he was a highly popular former governor of Tennessee. He was known for being a pragmatist. And he ran an incredibly well-funded, disciplined campaign against Marsha Blackburn.
And despite all of those advantages, he still only secured 43.9% of the statewide vote. He lost by almost 11 points.
Wow.
He carried the massive urban centers of Nashville and Memphis with huge margins, and he still lost comfortably.
Which perfectly highlights what political scientists call the urban limit. The math is incredibly unforgiving here. Even if Jerry Green gets 75% of the vote in Shelby County, which is Memphis, and 75% of the vote in Davidson County, which is Nashville, she still mathematically loses the election.
Exactly.
There are literally not enough human beings inside those city limits to outvote the rest of the state.
Which means she has to fundamentally alter how the rest of the state votes. And here's where the report gets mathematically precise.
Okay.
It charts a theoretical upset threshold detailing the exact county-by-county performance required for Green to squeak by with 50.6% of the vote. Oh. And the shifts required in voter behavior are massive.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if Memphis and Nashville are mathematically maxed out, she has to look at the suburbs and the rural counties. How much ground does this model say she actually has to make up?
It happens in three steps. First, she needs to hit 50 to 52% in Knox and Hamilton County, so Knoxville and Chattanooga.
Okay.
She essentially has to turn historically competitive or slightly Republican metros into solid Democratic wins.
That's tough.
Very. Second, she needs to capture 45 to 50% of the vote in the fast-growing Nashville suburbs, specifically places like Williamson and Rutherford counties.
I have to pause there because that is an incredibly heavy lift. Even Phil Bredesen, a beloved former governor, only managed about 40% in Williamson County back in 2018. She has to find another 10% of the electorate there who is willing to flip.
Exactly. But believe it or not, the suburbs aren't even the hardest part of the equation.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The most daunting number in this entire predictive model is the rural vote. Across the remaining 85 rural counties in Tennessee, Green has to average around 40% of the vote.
40%. Let me put that in perspective for you listening. In the 2024 presidential race, Kamala Harris only pulled about 21% of the vote across those deep red rural counties.
Right.
The model is asking a Democratic challenger to essentially double the party's vote share in the most conservative parts of the state. How does a campaign even attempt to engineer that kind of shift? How do you convince people who have voted Republican their entire lives to certainly check the box next to a D?
You do it through a mechanism called margin compression, which relies entirely on cross-pressured voters.
Cross-pressured, meaning they feel a conflict between their usual party loyalty and a specific urgent issue.
Precisely. To hit that 40% threshold, Green doesn't need these rural voters to suddenly become liberals. She needs them to experience cognitive dissonance.
Okay, give me an example.
She needs a working-class voter in a deep red county to say, I strongly prefer Republican policies nationally, but my local hospital just closed its maternity ward, and the Democrat is the only one offering a plan to fund it.
Oh.
Or she needs college-educated suburban women to cross party lines based specifically on abortion access or protecting their local public school from voucher programs.
Right. So it requires assembling a coalition of demographics that rarely vote together. She needs maximum turnout from Black voters in the urban centers, massive suburban crossover from disillusioned Republicans, and rural voters prioritizing their grocery bills over their ideological alignment, all happening simultaneously.
And she needs the other side's base to feel unmotivated and stay home. Because the math is so precarious, her internal strategy can only get her so far. She is heavily reliant on external variables that are completely outside of her campaign's control.
Which brings us to the X factors. Let's look at the national environment right now in late August 2026, because, you know, national waves often dictate local outcomes.
And right now, the national environment is incredibly volatile. The report highlights that as of today, Donald Trump's national approval rating has sunk to a record low of 33%.
Wow.
The electorate is experiencing war fatigue, and national inflation remains stubbornly high, with the U.S. Consumer Price Index sitting at 3.4%. Everyday essentials like food and energy are squeezing voters nationwide.
This raises an important question. Does a toxic national environment for Republicans actually damage a Republican incumbent at the state level?
Yes.
Usually when the president's approval rating is in the low 30s, it spells absolute disaster for their party in the midterms.
It normally would. But Tennessee has built a unique defense mechanism.
How so?
While the national economy is struggling with inflation, Tennessee's local economy is practically wearing a bulletproof vest. State unemployment is sitting at a historically low 3.4%. Job growth is steady.
So you have this bizarre dynamic where a voter is experiencing high prices at the grocery store, but they aren't worried about losing their job.
Right.
Green has to make her economic argument entirely about the cost of living because she can't point to a collapsed local job market.
Which gives Blackburn a massive rhetorical shield. She can point to the low unemployment rate and say, look, Tennessee is thriving under conservative state leadership. We just need to protect our borders and our values from the failures in Washington. She can use the state's economic stability to insulate herself from the national Republican headwinds.
Another critical X factor outside of Green's control is external funding. Will the cavalry actually show up?
The DGA.
Right, the Democratic Governors Association. They've publicly stated they want to go on offense and expand the map into red states. But as of this report's publication, they haven't committed a specific hard dollar amount to Green's campaign.
If the DGA parachutes in with a multi-million dollar independent expenditure, the entire paid media landscape changes overnight.
Yeah, suddenly Green can match Blackburn on the airwaves.
Exactly. But if they hesitate, Green is left fighting Blackburn's $12 million PAC army with whatever she can scrape together through grassroots fundraising.
And then there's the final X factor.
Yeah.
Sheer message discipline. Can Jerry Green relentlessly keep the spotlight on the grocery tax and the rural hospitals day after day while surviving an inevitable millions of dollars barrage of attack ads regarding ICE, deportations, and cultural flashpoints?
It is the ultimate test of political focus.
So what does this all mean? Why should you, the listener, who maybe isn't a political operative building polling models in a back room, care about these specific decimal points, county-level thresholds, and PAC expenditures?
Because breaking down this race reveals the underlying physics of our modern political system. While the third-party models give Green roughly a 1 to 5% chance of winning, with race raters uniformly calling this a safe or solid Republican seat, this deep dive shows you exactly what a perfect storm actually requires in a polarized era.
It isn't just about giving a soaring speech or having a clever slogan.
No, it's a mechanical puzzle.
Right.
To break the math, you need a national wave against the president, a massive, unexpected surge in outside financial resources, historical ticket splitting in the affluent suburbs, and unprecedented margin compression in deep red rural areas where voters decide a local hospital matters more than a party platform.
Right.
It requires human behavior to temporarily override structural partisanship.
It is the difference between running a traditional campaign and attempting to orchestrate a mathematical miracle.
Hmm.
Which leaves me with a final thought I really want you to mull over after we wrap up today.
We just spent this entire time looking at how a candidate can craft a platform entirely around undeniable physical local issues, like a literal tax on the milk and bread you buy, or fighting to ensure the emergency room stays open in your specific rural county.
Highly practical, physical problems that affect everyone, regardless of their voting history.
Exactly. But if a candidate focuses entirely on those undeniable local issues, and they still cannot break through the partisan wall of nationalized culture wars and federal border debates, what does that mean for the future of state-level governance?
Yeah, that's the real question.
Are we approaching a reality where all local elections, no matter how small or specific to the state, are destined to just become mini-presidential races? If the cost of your groceries cannot beat the national border debate in a state governor's race, does local politics even exist anymore? Or are we just voting for national teams all the way down the ballot?
It's a profound question about how we weigh our ideological identities against our immediate physical realities.
It really is. We can calculate the electoral math, analyze the fundraising, and map out the upset thresholds all day long. But if the voters ultimately decide they care more about the political storm happening three states away than the cracks in their own foundation, all those carefully constructed local models go right out the window. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep questioning the numbers, look closely at the strategy behind the ads you're seeing, and we'll catch you next time.